It is Monday, September the 12th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, could today's ceasefire be Syria's last chance?
I don't think it's Syria's last chance, but I think in the near term it is Syria's last chance to bring about a political settlement, certainly an end to hostilities.
North Korea's nuclear ambition living on. We'll talk with an expert about what's next. We'll also go to Paris for the latest on a possible new terror plot and remembering the 2001 terrorist attacks on New York and Washington. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Syrian opposition activists say intense airstrikes have killed dozens of people in rebel-held areas of Aleppo and Idlib just hours after a new U.S.-Russian agreement was reached to try to end the violence in Syria. Abu Khalid is a civil defense worker in Idlib. He said, quite simply, people were out buying things for their children in the market. Airstrikes landed in the middle of them, and there were high numbers of deaths and injuries. Earlier, Syrian state media reported the government of President Bashar al-Assad is ready to abide by the cessation of hostilities called for in the new agreement, a ceasefire scheduled to take effect at sundown today. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Trinity University analyst David Lesh if the ceasefire will hold.
I don't want to be too cynical about this agreement because it's a step in the right direction and nothing's going to happen in terms of resolving the conflict unless the U.S. and Russia get on the same page and compel their respective allies in and outside of Syria to move forward. However, there are many, many obstacles, as one might expect. Just getting this plan for cessation of hostilities to start, of course, if you were a betting person, you probably bet against this, but it's a step, and it's a step in the right direction, and nothing is happening unless there's this first step.
Is there anything different with this arrangement that there was with the one reached in late February?
Well, it's a little bit more detailed than the one in February. I think there's more knowledge involved from the breakdown of the first one that has been employed in this one to try to arrange conditions so that, to facilitate the success, particularly from the Russian and U.S. side. I think that with the Obama administration going out and there's a political horizon there in terms of trying to get some sort of a settlement. So there's a little bit more urgency on in Moscow and in Washington. And perhaps with this urgency, they'll lean on their respective allies in and outside of Syria to try to do what they can to meet the terms of the agreement, particularly the cessation of hostilities.
There's an Associated Press analysis of this agreement. It says the Syria deal offers hope, but Russia is calling the shots. It suggests that U.S. strategy seems to rest almost entirely on the good faith of the Russians.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Russia is the primary stakeholder. They made themselves the primary stakeholder when they intervened militarily last September. And I think the Obama administration, of course, which has been hesitant to assert itself militarily in Syria from the beginning, has acquiesced in that and basically has said to the Russians, if you can resolve this, go ahead and do so. If you can't, you're the ones who are going to be caught in a quagmire that will certainly hurt Moscow's standing in the region and internationally. So Russia is the stakeholder. I think, frankly, that Moscow definitely does want a political settlement, certainly one on their terms being the regime staying in power with perhaps not as many concessions as many outside of Russia would like to see. Particularly in terms of whether Bashar al-Assad should stay or go. But I think they do want a political settlement and avoid, if at all possible, any sort of quagmire, certainly of the type that they got caught in Afghanistan in the 1980s.
Is this Syria's last chance?
I don't think it's Syria's last chance, but I think in the near term it is Syria's last chance to bring about a political settlement, certainly an end to hostilities you know, particularly because the Russians and the U.S. seem to be, you know, as close as possibly can imagine on the same page. There's many, many obstacles to this. I mean, this war will end. All wars end. You know, if it's not now, it'll end a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. Like, everyone's hoping that this will catalyze movement toward ending the war sooner rather than later.
And will Bashar al-Assad more likely be still in power in some form?
That's a big question. I mean, as things stand right now, since Russia is, for the most part, the most important influencer, the most important stakeholder on the outside, and their wish is for Bashar al-Assad to remain in power. Again, if you were a betting person, you would say that certainly in the near term and medium term, that Bashar al-Assad probably will remain in power. Whether or not his power be circumscribed, I think depends on the negotiations if they do occur and on the disposition of forces on the ground.
That's David Lesh, a Middle East specialist and professor of history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Among the other stories we're following here on VOA, more sanctions possible after North Korea's latest nuclear test. Early results give conservatives the lead in Croatia's election. And U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton diagnosed with pneumonia, but recovering quickly, so say the doctors. Expanded coverage of those stories, a lot more at voanews.com and as always on the VOA mobile app.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
United States is considering more sanctions against North Korea following Pyongyang's fifth and largest nuclear test so far. Hours later, North Korea called efforts to add sanctions laughable and vowed to strengthen its nuclear program even further. And now, South Korea's Yonhap News Agency is reporting North Korea has completed preparations to conduct another nuclear test at any time. Also, South Korean officials are saying the North's capabilities with regard to these tests rapidly expanding, echoing concerns from others such as the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power.
This is more than brazen defiance. North Korea is seeking to perfect its nuclear weapons and their delivery vehicles so they can hold the region and the world hostage under threat of nuclear strike.
We asked North Korea scholar Troy Stangerone of the Korea Economic Institute for his thoughts on this latest nuclear test by Pyongyang.
I think the first and most disconcerting thing is they did make clear progress here. Early indications are that this test was twice as powerful as their previous test. The last test in January was only marginally different in terms of its yield, if anything, than the one they had done prior to that. So this is a clear step forward for them in terms of technology. Now, this does not necessarily mean, as they claim, that they have miniaturized and that they are able to take and mount it on a warhead. There are still reasons to think that may not be the case, but it is disconcerting that they do seem to be making significant progress in terms of upgrading their program. And then when you couple this with the advances they've made with their missile program as well this year, they are progressing much quicker along the path to having a weaponized nuclear weapon than I think many people believe.
And what about the timing of this latest nuclear test, just a few months after the last one?
I think this is the clear indication here, both when you couple the number of missile tests this year, or in general under Kim Jong-un, to where his father may have been much more cautious in moving the program forward. He may have actually viewed the program as something which he could use as leverage against other countries. It seems clear that Kim Jong-un is much more interested in getting an actual nuclear weapon that everyone would believe that could be utilized if he so choose to do so. And I think that's the significant difference between him and his father. And it's clearly indicated by not just the progress they made on the test, but the number of tests they're doing and how frequently they're doing them.
We also asked Angeron about the contention North Korea is very close to arming a short-range ballistic missile.
U.S. intelligence and Japanese intelligence and South Korean intelligence have both, for at least a year or two, thought that they were able to take and do this as well. So now you're seeing outside experts saying, based on what we can see, that's the case. I think practically speaking, we know that they're short-range ballistic missiles, the things that could hit, for example, Tokyo, perhaps Seoul, most likely those would be able to be armed. The real question is, you know, how well they've done the miniaturization side of it, but most likely they could probably take and do that at this point, which is disconcerting because this means that, you know, they do now most likely have an actual usable nuclear weapon.
That's Troy Stangerone with the Korea Economic Institute and a widely quoted expert on North Korea. Also in the news, two judicial sources are saying a 15-year-old boy has been arrested in Paris, suspected of preparing what they described as an imminent violent action. It is the second alleged plot with links to the Islamic State discovered in France in recent days. International Edition's Lori London speaks with Paris-based journalist Catherine Field about all of this.
It was a 15-and-a-half-year-old boy who's been under house arrest since April of this year. He was taken into custody by police who believed that he was planning an attack in a public place. He had apparently been in contact with a French jihadist in the Middle East, a 29-year-old Frenchman who's known to have been directing operations from Iraq and Syria with attacks that are carried out here in France. Now, this 15-and-a-half-year-old boy had apparently been in touch with him using an instant messaging service.
How did this boy become interested in terrorism or become radicalized?
That big question, no one knows the answer to. We were getting more news just in the last couple of hours, for example, from the Prime Minister, that this pool of people even who are radicalized has grown. Originally, we were led to believe that police had under surveillance some 10,000 people suspected of having been radicalized. Now he says it's 15,000 people inside France who they fear are being radicalized. But certainly, anybody can get onto the internet. Anybody can get onto some of these instant messaging services and be in touch with people who are putting out messages frequently about various targets in France, and also that key message which they play on and on about, which is that if you're a young Muslim, then you're not welcome in France. And that's how it's selling to these youngsters.
And they believe he was actually planning an actual attack?
In central Paris, yes, they believe that. And they say that this new web that they've discovered, which included some of the women who were linked to the foiled attempt on Notre Dame Cathedral last weekend. I mean, police are very slowly giving us more information about this big web that links not just this 15-and-a-half-year-old boy, but also the five women who've been taken into custody. They're suspected of having tried to carry out an attack on Notre Dame Cathedral. Also, these people have links to the killing of an elderly priest back in July. And also, that same group is said to have been in contact with the man who knifed to death a policeman and his partner back in June.
Wow. And so obviously the nation is still under a state of emergency after three attacks this year. Is that correct?
It's still a state of emergency, and that will continue for the foreseeable future. As if to make matters sort of more uncertain, the Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, in an interview just a couple of hours ago, warned that there will be new attacks and there will be yet more victims. And this comes just after 2 days ago when the Interior Minister said that police had foiled two attacks in the center of Paris on Thursday. Those attacks were meant to have been carried out at a major train hub here in the capital.
Paris-based journalist Catherine Field speaking with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
News happens around the clock. And VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Sunday, Americans remember the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, 2001, that took nearly 3,000 lives. Washington-based lawyer Frank Rizzano was one of the few people who escaped from New York's World Trade Center after the towers collapsed on September the 11th. On the morning the two hijacked planes hit the Twin Towers, he was fast asleep at the adjacent Marriott World Trade Center, a 22-story hotel where he was staying on business. Awakened by the impacts, he was still in his room when the South Tower collapsed and created a huge gash in the middle of the hotel, while also leaving its southern stairwell intact. Rizzano managed to make it down to the stairwell's third floor, where he, another guest, a hotel worker, and two firemen crawled down a beam through a wall opening to the second floor. Moments later, the North Tower fell, demolishing almost all of what remained of the Marriott except of a few floors at the southern edge where Rizzano and other survivors were trapped. In an interview with VOA's Michael Lippin in 2011, Rizzano described what happened next.
All I kept thinking to myself this time around was, this can't be happening to me twice in one day. I thought I was going to die because I couldn't breathe. Every breath you took, you drew in dust and dirt, and you couldn't get no oxygen. And I remember convulsively coughing, as did all of the other people in the group. Literally, it was like drowning. You know, after a few minutes of coughing and hacking, the dust and the debris starting to settle down, we were able to get some oxygen. After we regain our composure, the next thing I recall is the fireman, Jeff Johnson, starting to look around to find a way out. He looks around the room, and then he finds a hole in the wall on the West Street side of the building, and he takes either a rug or a drape that he found, wedges it in some debris, throws it over the side of the building, and he says, this is our way out. We're going to climb down this rug. You know, again, I said, oh boy, this is a little bit much for me to climb down this rug. But again, you know, the banquet manager of the hotel, he went down that rug, and I said, well, he made it. I can do it too. And I remember just as I was getting on the rug, the other guy saying to the fireman, he says, this is crazy. And at any rate, I went down the rug or the carpet and down to the debris pile. I remember looking around and thinking to myself, this looks like a nuclear bomb has gone off in the city. Just complete desolation. There was a cloud of dust and debris. There were things still falling down around you. We get past the debris pile, get to the other side of West Street, and Jeff said to the three of us, he said, you guys keep walking till you hit the river, and that's what we did. So we walk down, we get down to the river, and there's a policeman there, and he looked at me and he said, you're bleeding from the head. He says, you have to be evacuated out of the city. And to tell you the truth, until he said that to me, I didn't know I was bleeding. He said, I'm going to put you on a police boat. He said, we can't take you to a hospital in New York because there's no way to get out of the area. So we'll put you on the police boat and we'll take you to a hospital in New Jersey. And that's what they did. At Bayonne Hospital, they took a CAT scan and they said, look, you got some bleeding into the brain cavity and we're going to put you in intensive care. Fortunately, the bleeding stopped on its own. And 3 days later, they released me from the hospital. My wife had come up. And then we drove back to Washington. I was in no pain other than, you know, I had a lot of survivor's remorse or survivor's guilt, thinking, you know, why did you live?
Frank Rosano has returned several times to the site of the World Trade Center in New York since 2001. He told VOA's Michael Lippin that the courage of the rescuers who responded to the 9/11 attacks is far more important than his personal story and deserves to be remembered, as they are each year when the names of the first responders who died on September 11th are read, along with the many who died at what's been called Ground Zero. In the 15 years since the terrorist attacks, New Yorkers have witnessed Lower Manhattan's resurgence. The concept of rebuilding, however, will continue long after construction is completed there. Visitors and residents say the city feels safe today, but for many, their outlook on everyday life has forever changed. Here's VOA's Ramon Taylor.
One World Trade Center stands where the Twin Towers once did. Even taller than the original, the complex serves as a symbol of the city's resilience and strength. Despite the healing that has taken place, both locals and tourists agree, the city and the world will never be the same.
I think the world in total, it's not more safe than it was then. I think it's worse.
Wherever I go, I feel safe. However, unfortunately, these things can happen wherever you are.
Inside the 9/11 Memorial Museum, visitors explore the global impact of the 2001 attacks while reliving intimate accounts of grief and recovery. The museum's director says that at this year's anniversary, the progress at Ground Zero is evident.
You have magnificent new towers that are standing. You have Tower 3 rising. You have the new transportation hub, and you have this magnificent memorial in the center of it. So it is a place now of commemoration and of life.
But even after the last tower is finally complete, the building will continue. Ask any local who was in New York that day in 2001, and their darkest memories will come rushing back.
There were people who were involved and working in that area, and they came to school to pick up their kids. They were full of plaster.
I remember the smells from riding the subways days after and not knowing what it was, because there were stores that had closed because food was spoiling, and you wondered if what you were smelling was decaying bodies.
Within sight of One World Trade Center rests a manicured garden where there was once a jailhouse. Betsy Randolph sees this as a metaphor.
I'm surrounded with all this beauty and lushness. And underneath this is a history of what this once was. And look how far we've come. You could say that about 9/11 and post-9/11. Look how far we've come.
The garden is an oasis, a place where New Yorkers can reflect and find peace. But even in the city's quieter areas, New Yorkers have mixed feelings about whether they are safer overall.
I actually feel more in danger because of the provocation, because of separatism.
We enjoy a state of extreme security, safety, and there's someone responsible for that. There's someone invisible taking care of us.
Despite their concerns and differences, many New Yorkers who survived the city's darkest hour can still agree on one thing. There is no place they would rather be. Ramon Taylor, VOA News, New York.
Also on September the 11th, 2001, terrorist hijacked planes, which they flew into the U.S. military headquarters at the Pentagon outside Washington. President Obama was there on Sunday, remembering the many who died. And in the small community of Shanksville, Pennsylvania, where so many gathered to remember the passengers of United Airlines Flight 93, which was hijacked to possibly be flown into the White House here in Washington or the U.S. Capitol building. But the passengers on board Flight 93 did not allow that to happen and forced the hijackers to crash the plane into a field, killing all aboard.
We got a love.
Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Chaz Hall, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a pleasant Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
15 years ago, September 11, 2001, nearly 3,000 men, women, and children from over 90 countries died when terrorists used hijacked civilian aircraft to destroy the World Trade Center in New York City and damage the Pentagon near Washington, D.C. They crashed another civilian airliner in a field in Pennsylvania when the passengers, realizing the hijackers' intent, refused to allow them to attack yet another target and fought back. The world changed that day, not because of the deaths of 3,000 people or because the attack took place in the United States, but because a group of terrorists saw fit to inflict as much damage as possible on random civilian targets. The people who died that day represent a cross-section of ages, ethnicities, and religious affiliations. They had nothing the terrorists wanted, had done nothing to cause harm to their murderers. They died because it is the nature of terrorists to attack those who are least likely and able to fight back, and in that way to cause revulsion and horror in all civilized people. That is why the United States, along with the rest of the global community, confronts terrorism everywhere and advances freedom and democracy as an alternative to the ideologies of hatred and repression. September 11th is a date seared into the minds of all of us at the U.S. Department of State and of citizens across America. Together, we honor the memory of the men, women, and children murdered in 2001, said Secretary of State John Kerry in a written statement. We also remember those who died in yet another 9/11 terrorist attack 4 years ago in Libya. Ambassador Chris Stevens, Sean Smith, Glenn Doherty, and Tyrone Woods. They were brave, dedicated professionals who worked on behalf of their country to help others live in freedom, dignity, and peace, wrote Secretary of State Kerry. Friends and adversaries alike should understand. The United States will never be intimidated by terrorists, he said. Terrorists can cause tremendous suffering, but they can neither weaken our determination nor sway us from our purpose. For Americans at home and overseas, shared tragedy brings us together, adds to our vigilance, and strengthens our resolve not only on September 11th, but every day of the year.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
It's 4.